From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the massacres in Rwanda. We talk with human rights worker Allison DeForge. One friend in Rwanda phoned as she watched her neighbors being dragged out of their homes and shot. The friend was sure she was next. DeForge will tell us the story. Also, why nation states are disintegrating into ethnic civil war. We talk with Michael Ignatieff, author of Blood and Belonging, The New Nationalism. He traveled through six parts of the world torn apart by this nationalism. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Super Unknown, the new album by the Seattle band Soundgarden. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Polls in South Africa are crowded with voters today. There are some balloting problems. Some polls opened later because ballots and other materials didn't arrive on time. Meanwhile, South African police have made a giant step forward in connection with the bombings that have killed 21 people in South Africa. NPR's Ann Cooper says several suspects have been arrested in connection with the attacks.
Police have arrested 31 suspects in connection with today's bombing at Jan Smuts Airport outside of Johannesburg, as well as several other lethal bombings earlier this week. Police describe these people who've been arrested as members of the Afrikaner Resistance Movement and its Iron Guard, which is its military wing. And they say that two of those arrested were policemen. One of them is a police reservist.
NPR's Ann Cooper. Police also say they've seized a cache of weapons and explosives. Meanwhile, Inkatha Freedom Party leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi says he cannot rule out the possibility he'll take his party out of the elections. He told several news services today the Independent Electoral Commission has run out of Inkatha stickers, which are supposed to be pasted on the bottom of ballots. The Inkatha Party dropped its election boycott just over a week ago and agreed to join the balloting. Buthelezi says a shortage of ballot stickers is alarming. Meanwhile, voting goes on into the night in the South African elections. Polling officials have pushed back poll closing times from 7 p.m. to midnight local time. Officials also say they may have to extend the voting into Friday. Tomorrow was supposed to be the last day to cast a ballot. Authorities in Lafayette, Indiana, say two people have been killed by a tornado. Scott Newman of member station WILL has this report.
The tornado struck the northwestern Indiana town just after midnight, as many people were sleeping, a fact that authorities say contributed to the deaths and a high number of injuries. After touchdown, the funnel ripped through a factory, a housing subdivision, a trailer park, and several other buildings. Tippecanoe County Sheriff's Captain Steve Grant says the cleanup effort in Lafayette is underway.
Basically, our jobs are done other than providing security for the people that still have clothing and things they need to get out of these trailers and houses that are damaged.
Police are continuing their search for the injured with the aid of dogs, but they don't expect to find any more bodies. For National Public Radio, I'm Scott Newman reporting.
Oklahoma Senator David Boren is resigning his office at the end of the current session. The Democrat will become president of the University of Oklahoma. Observers say the announcement has long been awaited. Boren has said he thinks he can provide the greatest public service by educating the next generation. He'll stay in the Senate through the fall term to work on campaign finance reform and health care reform. The New York Stock Exchange is closed today. The markets are observing the National Day of Mourning for former President Richard Nixon. This is NPR. The United States and countries in the Persian Gulf have pledged to keep trade restrictions on Iraq. The Saudi foreign minister has released a statement saying Persian Gulf countries will stand vigilant against Iraq. Saudi Arabia released the statement after Secretary of State Warren Christopher met with a foreign minister and King Fahd. Saudi Arabia has also issued its support for peacemaking efforts in the Middle East. Christopher is going to Cairo tomorrow, where Israeli and Palestinian negotiators are still working to solve the blocks to Palestinian autonomy. The public viewing of former President Richard Nixon's coffin is over. The funeral ceremony will begin shortly in Yorba Linda, California. That's the site of the Nixon birthplace and library. President Clinton will deliver part of the eulogy. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports from Los Angeles.
In addition to President Clinton, eulogies will be delivered by California Governor Pete Wilson, Senator Robert Dole, and Richard Nixon's former Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger. The service will be conducted by the Reverend Billy Graham for 1,800 invited guests from 55 countries. Thousands of Southern Californians have viewed his flag-draped casket in the flower-filled lobby of his presidential library. The line stretched for half a mile along Yorba Linda Boulevard, and many people waited through rain and hailstorms for 3 hours for an opportunity to say their last farewells. Mr. Nixon will be laid to rest on the grounds of the library beside his wife, Pat, who passed away last year. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
Some members of Congress are asking the Federal Reserve not to increase interest rates anymore. 44 lawmakers have signed a letter accusing the Fed of launching preemptive strikes against non-existent inflation. They're asking Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan to stop boasting short-term interest rate higher. The independent central bank has increased short-term rates 3 times since February. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. More than 100,000 people have been massacred in the past 3 weeks in Rwanda. Many Rwandans in jeopardy have been calling my guest Alison Desforges. She's the co-chair of the International Commission on Human Rights Abuse in Rwanda and consultant to Human Rights Watch Africa on Rwanda and Burundi. She's also a historian specializing in Rwanda and Burundi. This latest wave of political and ethnic violence was touched off April 6th when a plane carrying the presidents of Burundi and Rwanda crashed, killing both presidents. Just a few hours after the crash, Alison Desforges got a phone call from her friend Monique Mujawa Maria, a Rwandan human rights worker. Mujawa Maria heard approaching gunfire and was trapped in her house. She called Desforges in desperation. This began a series of phone calls between them that lasted through the night.
At 4 a.m., she called and said that the presidential guard had arrived in her neighborhood, that they had entered a house, a couple of houses removed from hers. They had taken from that house 3 people, including a man who worked for her human rights association. She had seen them killed, the 3 of them executed on the street corner. The bodies were still lying there. An hour later, we were on the phone again, and 2 hours later, and she told me that they were in the house next door to hers, that they had brought out a young man, and they were killing him, and I could hear the rifle fire. Then at 6:20, she said, "They're at my door." I could hear the gunshots. She said, "What can I do?" I had already discussed with her the possibility of trying to find a place to hide. I'd suggested she put on some dark clothes so that she would be less visible if she found a place to hide. She's a person who loves brilliant colors. And I said, "Monique, you got to find something old, dirty, and black and put it on." She also had the inspiration to take off her fingernail polish and cut her nails short so that she could try to pass as an ordinary woman of the countryside instead of a city person. And it was when they were at the door and she started to panic. I said, "Look, let them in, open the door, stay on the line with me, hand the phone over, and I'll try to carry this off." Because Monique had been at the White House. She'd been received by President Clinton last December. That was known in Rwanda. And I thought perhaps this would be one way to impress them enough to leave her alone. Her reaction was, "No, I don't think that would mean anything. I don't think it'll work." And then she asked me, "Please take care of my children." And I said, "Monique, don't hang up." She said, "I don't want you to hear this." And then she hung up.
You think what she didn't want you to hear was what she expected to be her own death?
Right.
So then what happened? She hid.
She ran out in the back, and she hid outside for a while in the bush. And then she came back and climbed into the ceiling and spent 40 hours perched on a very small rafter, not moving, not eating, not drinking, going to the bathroom. As she said later on, she wasn't even sure she breathed during that time. And then after all those hours, she came down, and I had, in the meantime, called and gotten someone who worked at her house on the phone and had discovered she was alive. And then she came down and spoke to me, and we set to work to try to find some way to get her from that house into town. Soon after that, phone lines were cut, and it was no longer possible for me to help her. I had, with the help of colleagues in Canada and in Europe and at the UN, I had secured 3 channels of escape for her, 3 possible ways to get out of the country, but I had no way to let her know that information.
How did she get from her house to a place of safety?
she basically bought her life. After several days of hiding, she became convinced that her house was going to be invaded and she was going to be caught by the militia. And here there's an important distinction between the militia, who are much less disciplined bands of killers, and the military itself. And she thought she would have a better chance with soldiers than with the militia, because she herself had been married to a military officer for some 14 years. So she decided to take her risks, and she took a photo album that had pictures both of her marriage and of a number of high-ranking military officers who had at different times been guests in her home, and went out and approached a group of young soldiers who were camped in her backyard and said, you know, I'm the wife of an important military man. He's off fighting the rebels, and I need you to give me an escort into town.
Of course, the truth is she had left her husband years before.
Right, because he had beaten her unmercifully. But they didn't know that, and she did have the pictures of herself as a smiling bride. So she used that, plus approximately $750 to buy her life, and persuaded one of these young soldiers at that price to drive her into town.
And now she's in the United States speaking for her country?
Right, yes.
Do you know a lot of people from Rwanda and Burundi who weren't as lucky as Monique?
Yes. In Rwanda and Burundi, people exchange name cards. It's a custom that carries over from Europe. And in the last week or so, I've discarded about half of my name cards.
The fighting now is between Hutus and Tutsis.
Wrong.
Okay.
The fighting now is between an extremist group that surrounded President Habyarimana, who are Hutu. And they are attacking and slaughtering members of the opposition, who are both Hutu and Tutsi. And as well, they are carrying on a war against a largely Tutsi force called the Rwandan Patriotic Front. So what you have is two levels of conflict, two kinds of conflict. You have formal military engagements between the RPF and the Rwandan army. And that is producing, I suppose, you know, a certain number of casualties. But that's not what we're talking about when we're talking about 100,000 people dead. The 100,000 people who are dead are civilians, unarmed, defenseless civilians, who are both Hutu and Tutsi. The initial victims, some of the most outstanding, the victims we know best in the first hours of violence, the prime minister, for example, Agathe Uwilimana, the president of the Supreme Court, Mr. Kavuruganda, they were Hutu. And so it was a case of Hutu members of the presidential guard executing Hutu opposition politicians.
So does this fighting have much to do with ethnicity, or is it about political power?
It's about political power. And this is a very, very important point, because often commentators and journalists and even our own policymakers in Washington look at this, and because it's happening on the African continent, they figure it must be different from power struggles in other parts of the world. It must be, quote, tribal. And they automatically stick this label onto it, in part because they don't care enough to really inform themselves, but in part also because it then excuses them from any form of action. They can reason, well, this is a tribal conflict, it's ethnic hatred, it's something which has been since the dawn of time, and they assume, of course, that Africa never changes, right? There is no history on this continent in their eyes, it's an unchanging thing. And since it's always been that way, it will always be that way, and therefore we have no role to play in trying to resolve the situation. On the other hand, if you look at it as it really is, as a struggle for power by a group of extremists who had been in power for 20 years and didn't want to give up the goodies, didn't want to share in a situation of extreme poverty where control of the state is the only game in town, then if you understand this as a political struggle over the control of the state, then you can foresee or begin to envision some kinds of solutions which are practical and which require action on the part of the international community.
What do you think can be done to resolve the conflict now?
Well, we who work in human rights have come to the conclusion, I think, that a lot of our strategies in the past for dealing with oppressive governments have been ineffective. We have often relied on sanctions, asking our own government and other governments to impose sanctions on governments that repress their own citizens. And we found that this is far too clumsy a strategy, and that, in fact, often the people we most wish to target end up benefiting because a black market develops, for example, to get around sanctions, and then these are the guys who control the black market, so they end up profiting from them instead of being punished by them. And in a case like Rwanda, where the catastrophe is overwhelming, of course, something like sanctions is far too remote and again, too clumsy to be effective. So what we're trying to do is find a new strategy. And what we are coming to is increasing the realization that there must be accountability. We must insist upon accountability from the people who are themselves personally involved in launching these kinds of massacres. So what we are trying to do is to persuade the world community to call upon those people in responsible positions of power and to put their names before the world community so that they become known as individuals. One of the reasons that people are willing to go to such lengths to take control of a state is all the personal benefits and perks that they will get from being in power. You know, being able to land their private jets someplace, being able to take a vacation on the Riviera, being able to send their children to Canada or the United States to study, being able to send their wives to Paris for plastic surgery, whatever. We hope that by putting the names of responsible individuals before the world community now, we will alert them to how difficult it's going to be for them in the future to enjoy any benefits from the kind of slaughter that they're now engaging in.
Have you tried that approach before?
No, this is a new approach. And as a matter of fact, last Friday, the White House issued a press statement calling upon the commander-in-chief of the Rwandan army, Augustin Bizimungu, Colonel Bagasora, Colonel Nkundiye, Captain Simbikangwa, and Colonel Mhiranya, who is the head of the presidential guard, naming them as people who have the power to end the slaughter and asking them to do so immediately. This was, I believe, the first time that the White House has ever taken such a step. We're encouraging our colleagues in Europe to ask their governments to take the same kind of step. And along with this, which is directed at identifying responsible individuals and calling upon them to act responsibly, along with that, we are hoping to get a declaration from our own government and all other potential aid givers, that a declaration that a regime built upon thousands of bodies will never be supported by international assistance. This is crucial because Rwanda has in the past relied very heavily upon international aid, both bilateral aid and aid that comes through multilateral groups like the World Bank and so on. And we hope that by making it clear to these extremists that they have no hope of money for their regime in the future, that they will understand the futility of their action. Now, this may not dissuade them, but we hope that if we can broadcast this widely enough within Rwanda, that it will dissuade moderates who might be on the point of joining them and may even persuade these moderates to begin to act to take control back from the extremists.
My guest is Alison DeForge, a consultant to Human Rights Watch Africa. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with historian and human rights activist Alison DeForge. You've been working with human rights groups for several years. Why do you think the massacres in Rwanda are so savage. And, I mean, we're talking here about attacks with machetes and spears. We're talking about infants being cut up. It's just really hard to conceive of this. These are not your typical human rights violations.
No. I explain everything and understand nothing, I guess, is what it comes down to. On the one hand, I want to say that killing is killing. And whether with a machete or a gun is a little bit irrelevant. We tend to sometimes get fixated on the gory aspects of these things and to think that it's, quote, more primitive or more horrible because it's done in one fashion than another. From my point of view, it really doesn't matter. But I think it's very important in this context to point out that a great deal of the killing that's being done is not being done by machetes and what's called in French arme blanche, but instead is being done by AK-47s, by repeating rifles, and that in fact there would be far, far fewer victims in this slaughter if the arms-producing nations of Europe, East and West Europe, and Asia and North America had not been so successful in selling their arms in this region. We know now that in preparation for these murderous slaughters, Habyarimana and officials in his government distributed firearms free, 30,000 in one commune. And it's because there are those firearms available that the death toll has gone up so rapidly.
Who did the president distribute the guns to for free?
To members of the militia attached to his own political party and the political party known as CDR. These party organizations have been in existence now for a couple of years. They grew up after human rights organizations began publicizing the fact that government officials were organizing massacres of Tutsi and opposition people. And this caused bad press for Habyarimana, and to avoid that, he created these militias so that it would be done by party people rather than by government people.
So he gave out guns to people for free, hoping that when he was ready for it, they would carry out massacres?
Not hoping. Knowing.
Well, how do you organize something like that?
Well, you organize it by a 3-year campaign of propaganda over the radio, teaching people whom they should kill and whom they should hate. And then you take your local party cells and you find the people who most need money and power, and you give them that money and power, and then you pay a smaller amount to the ordinary worker, so to speak, and you train them militarily, as was done. Members of these militia were trained by the presidential guard, by soldiers, in how to kill. And then you get them primed for the right moment, and you provide the pretext and send them out.
And in this case, the pretext was
the plane crash,
the death of the president.
The death of the president. Right.
So everybody knew what they were supposed to do.
Within 10 minutes of the crash, the barricades were on the roads. Within an hour of the crash, killings had begun 60 kilometers away.
Now that the president is dead, who is the leader?
Well, these colonels whom I mentioned are officially in charge of the military forces. They put together a kind of rump government, a pretend government, that included some ministers who had previously served under Habyarimana. And that government supposedly is in their eyes, a legitimate government. But so far, it has not had too much success in being accepted as legitimate elsewhere in the world. Although I have to express serious concern here, because I know that representatives of this government, including the head of the political party that is responsible for the slaughtering of thousands of defenseless civilians, are today and were yesterday received by the government in France. And perhaps the French are going to move towards some form of acknowledgement or even recognition of these people.
You've mentioned radio propaganda campaigns. What were those campaigns?
Well, the national radio had been used since the start of the war with the RPF, that was October 1990, to identify what were called ibtizo, accomplices. And this meant anyone within Rwanda who was part of the political opposition or who was a person of the Tutsi group. These people were said to be accomplices of the foreign invaders. And that was a tune which began to be sung over the national radio in October 1990 and was carried through right up until the present time. When it became a little embarrassing for the national radio to carry this out in recent months, a private radio was established to take up and amplify this horrible song of hatred. And it included broadcasts such as, "The grave at such and such a site is only half full. Who can help us fill it up by 10 o'clock tonight?" That kind of thing. Clearly targeting anyone who had been a critic of President Habyarimana, including naming people by name, such as Monique Mujawa Maria,
the human rights activist. How did they name her?
They named her in connection with some popular songs that had the woman's name Monique in it. They would play these songs over the radio, and then the announcer would cut in and say, "Ah, yes, we have a person named Monique in our country as well, but she's a little bit different from the person in the song. She's a traitor to our country. She's an evil person. She deserves to die the most horrible death, as do her children, and we're sure that that's going to happen to them one of these days."
Are there other friends in Rwanda who you've been trying to protect?
Yes, a number of people. Phone service was cut off about, time escapes me. I think it was maybe a week ago, maybe 10 days ago. The government cut the phones so that we would be unable to know the details of the massacres that were going on. Phone service was restored yesterday. Last night, during the night, I had a number of phone calls from people who are in desperate circumstances. One, a doctor who is had taken refuge in a hotel in Kigali. He's there with about 500 other people. They have been subject to repeated attack by government troops. They have been without food or water for 1 week. He is trying to help the wounded and to help women who are giving birth on the floor of the hotel without water. I've also received calls for help concerning 5,000 people who have been without food, imprisoned in a stadium in southwestern Rwanda in Changugu since April the 15th. I've received calls from families in Kigali who haven't had food for 9 or 10 days and ask me what to do with their children.
What are you telling the people who are calling you?
I tell them I'm doing what I can, and I try to encourage them to stay brave, and I try to describe all the things that we've been doing to try to move public opinion here and to try to get some action from our government and to get some reconsideration at the United Nations of their disgraceful vote to withdraw their peacekeeping force. I'm torn between lying promises and telling a truth which is absolutely full of despair, and sometimes I just don't know what to say.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Alison DeForge is a consultant to Human Rights Watch Africa. She's an assistant professor of history at the State University of New York at Buffalo. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Nationalism used to hold nations together. Now it's tearing them apart. Coming up, we talk with journalist Michael Ignatieff, author of a new book about violent ethnic nationalism called Blood and Belonging. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Super Unknown, the new album by the Seattle band Soundgarden. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The South African Elections Commission is extending today's polling hours and keeping polling places open until the last voters cast ballots tomorrow. People have been thronging to the polls for the nation's first all-race elections. Reg Austin is with the United Nations Elections Observer Team. He told NPR yesterday's voting was a mixed bag.
The task which was given to the Electoral Commission was a momentous and extraordinary task. They were asked in a period of 3 months, virtually, to build up an entirely new scale of electoral service in this country. And that meant that they faced problems of logistics and planning and staffing, which they'd never had to deal with before. And I think one of the evidences of this is, in fact, to be seen in some of the problems that we're facing now.
Reg Austin, a UN elections observer in South Africa. Meanwhile, police in Johannesburg say they've arrested 31 people in connection with a series of bombings in South Africa that have killed 21 people. The latest explosion came this morning when a bomb went off at the Johannesburg International Airport. The national police chief says those arrested include a policeman, a reserve officer, and several members of the extreme right-wing Afrikaner resistance movement. Police also say they've seized a large number of weapons and explosives. Investigators from Japan and Taiwan say they've narrowed down the possible causes of the crash of a Taiwanese airliner at a Japanese airport. More than 260 people died in yesterday's disaster. Philip Short reports from Tokyo.
Investigators have established that the pilot decided to abort the landing and come in for a new approach about 90 seconds before the plane was due to touch down. Eyewitnesses saw the nose of the aircraft pull up to begin climbing again, but then, 30 seconds later, the plane hit the ground just short of the main runway. A Japanese expert, Hiroshi Fujiwara, who's a former head of the government's Air Crash Investigation Committee, said there were two possible explanations. Either the aircraft stalled because the pilot tried to climb too steeply, or the engine compressors shut down, again because of the steep climb, causing one or both engines to catch fire. Eyewitnesses described seeing flashes of light from the wings shortly before the crash.
Philip Short reporting for the BBC. The Bosnian Serbs have left Garajda. Relief workers are in the city trying to help the residents. The water plant for the town has been wrecked, the hospital is destroyed, and thousands of refugees are hungry. United Nations officials say the Serbian advance drove people from villages into the Garajda city center. Ham radio operators in the city say the UN must now deal with the refugees. This is NPR News from Washington. The health of school-aged children around the world is the focus of a new United Nations-related initiative. Linda Fasulo reports.
90% of the children in developing nations now live to age 5, due largely to successful international infant medical programs. But then a gap develops in the international treatment of common school-age illnesses such as parasitic worms. While uncommon in industrialized nations, worms infect 500 million school-aged children and kill up to 100,000 of them each year. The parasites hamper physical and sometimes mental development. But the UN Development Program says a simple, low-cost treatment could cure most cases. To help do so, the Development Agency and several foundations have formed the Partnership for Child Development to work along with third world governments. Another focus will be on treating widespread vitamin deficiencies. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo reporting.
Witnesses are testifying at the assisted suicide trial of Dr. Jack Kevorkian. He's accused of helping Thomas Hyde kill himself. Some witnesses say Kevorkian was only trying to relieve Hyde's suffering when he hooked him up to a canister of carbon monoxide, even though death was going to be the result. Kevorkian's defense is claiming Michigan's ban on assisted suicide lets doctors prescribe medication to relieve suffering, even if it hastens death. The Chrysler Corporation says it won't participate in tomorrow's national program called Take Our Daughters to Work Day. The automaker says the program discriminates against boys. Chrysler today asked workers to leave their daughters at home. The program is sponsored by the Ms. Foundation for Women. Sponsors say the program provides girls with a look at different career opportunities. The Ms. Foundation says studies show that when girls and boys participate in educational programs together, boys receive more attention. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. How does ethnic pride turn into ethnic cleansing? That's what Michael Ignatieff set off to find out. He traveled to six areas torn apart by ethnic nationalism, including the Balkans, Ukraine, Kurdistan, and Ireland. He reports on his findings in his new book, Blood and Belonging, Journeys into the New Nationalism. It's a companion to his BBC series of the same name. Ignatieff says you may think that we're moving beyond nationalism toward a global culture, but in fact, the New World Order is the disintegration of nation-states into ethnic civil war. He had some frightening illustrations of this disintegration when he was stopped at checkpoints. He told me about one such experience at a UN checkpoint between a Croat and Serb-held section of central Croatia.
The Serb lines are divided from the Croatian lines by a UN checkpoint manned by some Canadian teenagers. But within about 10 yards from that checkpoint, our bus was boarded by some drunken Serbian paramilitaries who were at a wedding. They were brandishing bottles of plum brandy, and they wrenched the door of the van open when they realized that we were foreign journalists. And someone had seen us talking to some Croatians on the other side of the line, so they immediately concluded we were spies. They began yanking us out of the bus. One of them jumped into the bus and began to try and drive it off. And when we protested, he pulled out a Zastava pistol and pointed it at our heads. And the camera crew was saying, "Oh, God, can't we shoot this?" And someone said, "Well, they'll probably shoot us if they do." And it spiraled very quickly into kind of ethnic paranoia and macho aggression, just short of murder. And there was about 30 seconds, a minute, when I thought, I'm not going to get out of here alive. And then a UN soldier came running up from the checkpoint, reached in through the window and grabbed the keys of the car, cocked his M16 and said, "I think we better sort this out my way," at which point a local Serbian policeman came running in, cocked his pistol and said, "No, we're going to sort it out my way," and we ended up spending 4 hours in a Serbian police station. And the moral of the story is that this is what the New World Order looks like face to face.
What is what it looks like?
Well, what it looks like is that the international community has put two teenage boys in between two feuding ethnic groups, given them very limited power to do anything, and within about 50 yards of these checkpoints mandated by diplomats in distant countries, it's a complete law of the jungle, and you can lose your lives crossing between one zone and the other.
You saw a lot of young men with guns at checkpoints and paramilitaries patrolling around, and you thought they had a semi-sexual relationship with their guns.
Well, a lot of kids have a semi-sexual relationship to their guns in, you know, South Central L.A. What's different in places like Yugoslavia is that this is a nationalist set of passions. That is, you got a lot of unemployed, semi-criminal, semi-delinquent kids who are recruited by local warlords to protect their people and are pumped up and pumped full of a nationalist rhetoric, which makes them defenders of their people. And when you do that, then everything is permitted. And so these kids swagger around at the checkpoints, flaunting their weapons at you, and they have behind them this kind of, I don't know, cultural mandate to behave as they do, which is to threaten you and taunt you and occasionally put a bullet in your head. And it's that junction between kind of nationalist rhetoric and erotic fantasy which produces a lot of really psychotic behavior in the South Balkans. I'm not saying the whole region is a kind of fanatical and erotically insane zone, but you can't make sense of the gratuitous violence and cruelty in that area. You know, 200,000 people have died, and often in very bestial and horrible circumstances. You can't make sense of that unless you see the ways in which the erotic energies of young men and the nationalist energies of politics are kind of fused together into one big green light for, you know, sadistic behavior.
One of the people you met with was Melovangelas.
Yes.
Who was one of the key architects of post-war Yugoslavia and then broke with Tito in 1953. And he told you that he thought that the West had made a big mistake in satanizing, in demonizing the Serbs. What was his explanation for that?
Well, it's extremely interesting that Gilas, who is the first dissident in Eastern Europe, the very first one, I mean, you know, 25 years before Havel, 25 years before anybody else, for him to say that we demonize the Serbs is interesting because he's under almost semi-house arrest in Serbia for being so unpopular in Serbia. But his point was that the West wanted a simple story about ex-Yugoslavia. The West wanted good guys and bad guys and very quickly found the bad guy in Milosevic, when in fact the truth is that the collapse of Yugoslavia was a kind of fatal dynamic interaction between two nationalisms, or three nationalisms, in fact, Serbian nationalism, Croatian nationalism, Slovenian nationalism, and also Muslim nationalism. There's absolutely no doubt that Serbia bears the preponderant responsibility for the catastrophe. They were the aggressors in Croatia. The Bosnian Serbs were the aggressors in Bosnia. But you can't understand some of the Serbs' paranoia and murderous hatred unless you understand the extent to which they felt threatened by Croatian nationalism and Muslim nationalism. This is not to excuse the Serbs, to justify what they did, but a true understanding of what's happening there doesn't fixate on them alone as the source of the violence and doesn't fixate on them as the sole people responsible for ethnic cleansing. There's been ethnic cleansing on all sides. It doesn't make everybody equivalently guilty. It just makes the point that this is a very, very complex, tragic interaction between nationalisms which actually cannot be satisfied in the region. That's the key point. Nationalism is a fatal dream in the Balkans because there is, you know, because these ethnic groups are so interpenetrated, they live so much on top of each other, that for a nationalist to achieve his dream, which is to have all the Serbs in one state, requires him to engage in ethnic cleansing, requires him to drive out all the neighbors he lives on top of. Similarly, for a Croatian to dream of a Croatian nation requires him to drive out the ethnic Serbs in Croatia. And similarly, to the extent that there is a Muslim nationalism, it, unless it's prepared to accept multi-ethnicity and a kind of confessional difference in a society, it's required to push people out. That's what makes nationalism so truly suicidal in this region. You can only achieve the dream at the price of other people's blood.
My guest is Michael Ignatieff, author of the new book Blood and Belonging, Journeys into the New Nationalism. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Ignatieff, author of Blood and Belonging, Journeys into the New Nationalism. One of your earlier books had to do with Russian history and your personal connection to Russian history through your grandparents and great-grandparents. In your new book, you write that being yourself is what ethnic nationalism will not allow. You've, I think, really looked to your past, looked to your your heritage, for a sense of your identity. And I'm wondering if you keep kind of shifting the line between what's healthy and what's unhealthy in terms of getting identity from the past, from your ethnic heritage, from your ancestors, from where they were from.
I think being an expatriate, that is being someone born in country, in one country, making his life somewhere else, I have given a lot of thought to belonging and roots, and my past is plural. You know, it's Scottish, Canadian, and Russian, and all this and that. And that, I think, led to a quite often quite anguished search for my roots and for my belonging that can be seen in previous books of mine, like the Russian album. I think what has the nationalism book and Blood and Belonging taught me is just how dangerous it is to fully belong. There are claims of the past which can really unhinge people. There are mythologies of the past that kind of rise up from the grave and take possession of a people and can do them terrible harm. I mean, one of the moments in literature that always haunts me is that wonderful moment when when Juliet is up on the balcony and Romeo's hidden in the shadows, and Juliet is sort of thinking to herself, and she's a Montague, he's a Capulet, or the other way around, and she's trying to think about what is the nature of the claim of her family upon her. And she wants passionately to say, I am just Juliet. That's what I am first and last. I am not a prisoner of my family. I am not a prisoner of my past. I am not, by extension, a prisoner of these kind of ethnic gangs. And therefore, if I'm being told that I can't have anything to do with this man I love, the thing that is my enemy here is his name, and it's only a name. And I think that speaks very much to what is terrible about ethnic nationalism at its worst, is that it encloses people in a kind of total belonging, which simply swallows up the gulf that always exists between a personal identity and a national and social one. And it just, it deprives people of that kind of basic freedom to choose what they will belong to and choose in how far they will belong to something. And at its limits, when people are imprisoned by an identity, when it takes them over completely, it also takes over their conscience. And so they'll do anything in its name. And I felt I spent a year with a lot of people with guns who had simply surrendered themselves in some very deep human way. They simply could no longer listen to an individual voice of conscience that would say, it isn't such a great idea to shoot men, women, and children.
Do you think there are big differences between civic nationalism and ethnic nationalism?
Yes, a civic nationalism is rather the kind that you find in America. I mean, a civic nationalism says it doesn't matter what your ethnicity is, it doesn't matter where you come from, it doesn't matter what your blood is. What matters is whether you subscribe to the values and institutional rules of something called America. It's an allegiance to the state rather than allegiance to a particular ethnic nation. And now, it is true that most civic nations depend on a certain common tradition, set of experiences. But the great thing about the American case is that you have what all the international studies show is the most intensely patriotic and on occasion nationalistic society on earth. I mean, America is the home of the strongest form of nationalism there is, the most intense form of patriotic pride. But it's not accompanied by this kind of cruel and excluding emphasis on ethnicity. In fact, it's an incorporating kind of nationalism. It says everybody can belong to this dream. And what's astonishing is how powerful it is. Now, it may surprise Americans to hear themselves described as the most nationalistic society on earth. But in a sense, if you live outside America, that's what you feel. I don't say it in any hostile spirit because I feel tremendous attachment for a tradition that has, you know, Jefferson and Lincoln at the heart of it, as opposed to some call to ethnic blood and roots.
I think one of the big issues for the citizens of America and of England, where you live, is what is our responsibility to other countries that are torn apart now by ethnic fighting, places like Bosnia, like Rwanda, like Kurdistan. What is your impulse to feel that that we can intercede and help in other parts of the country? Is your impulse to first take care of what's wrong in your own part of the world?
I think there's absolutely no doubt that charity and moral commitment and moral obligation begins at home, and a society that doesn't look after its own is not a decent society. But I do think we have obligations overseas. I am a kind of cautious liberal internationalist. I think that we could have sent very clear, unequivocal signals to all the parties in the Bosnia and the Balkan conflict in 89 and 90 that might have stopped 200,000 people dying. Doesn't involve commitment of ground troops. It doesn't involve massive hemorrhaging commitments like Vietnam. It just means making very clear what our values and our commitments are so that bullies, so that dictators, so that demagogues know exactly where the six or seven most powerful nations in the world stand in relation to what they're trying to do. And we didn't do that after 89, and we could have. And we're now, and it's not us who are paying the price, it's the 200,000 people who've died in the Balkans who are paying the price. I'm a cautious liberal internationalist. We can't put the world to rights. We can't create law and order and a stable state in the Balkans. Only the people of the Balkans can do that. But we can tell them where we stand, and we can tell them that we won't allow violence and aggression and the forcible changing of frontiers by violence to go unpunished. And we haven't done that. We've let the demagogues, we've let the men of violence get away literally with murder. It's not, we can't live in a safe world if the international order means nothing. We can't live in a jungle. That's why, you know, this isn't a distant story. I haven't gone to the other side of the moon. I've gone to places that are within hours flying time from all the zones of safety in the world. And if we don't take our responsibilities seriously, those zones of danger will come creeping closer and closer and closer.
Michael Ignatieff, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Michael Ignatieff is the author of Blood and Belonging, Journeys into the New Nationalism. It's the companion to his BBC series of the same name. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on the South African elections?
Ann Cooper is reporting on the first day of voting from Johannesburg, Terry. And we also have Suni Khalid in Durban, who will be talking about Mangosuthu Buthelezi, who was threatening this morning the possibility of pulling out once again to pull his followers out, the Inkatha Freedom Party. We're also covering the Nixon funeral, and for those of us my age, Nixon was a dominating figure in the political scene, but we're going to ask some high school kids what they know about Richard Nixon. Also, Sylvia Poggioli reporting on fascists in Italy.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last year, the readers of Sassy Magazine voted the Seattle Quartet Soundgarden America's Ugliest Band. So they may not be the most attractive group, but rock critic Ken Tucker thinks they've come up with an important hard rock release called Super Unknown.
It's been a good long time since a band took all the elements of classic hard rock, the grinding guitars, the pummeling drums, the squalling lead singer, and came up with anything significant. Super Unknown is Soundgarden's fourth album, and it doesn't sound like their previous releases. Before now, Soundgarden was pretty much your typical Seattle band, plying their grunge at top volume with little shape or purpose to their songs. This time out, though, there's a carefully achieved intensity to Soundgarden's music that gives it a new urgency.
Seize the day, pull the trigger, drop the
singer Chris Cornell really knows how to let loose with leather lung bellowing. Like every other vocalist working in this genre, Cornell owes a lot to Led Zeppelin's Robert Plant. But over the course of this album, Cornell comes into his own, demonstrating that he can reach a lower register than Plant and can invest his screams with his own brand of melancholy agony. 9 times out of 10, I have to look at the lyric sheet to see what's causing his pain, and even after reading the words, their psychedelic aimlessness doesn't yield much in the way of meaning. But the emotions are clear enough on a song like Let Me Drown. Crammed with more than 70 minutes of music, Super Unknown's best strategy is its rejection of the hip numbness that characterizes so much Seattle grunge. Super Unknown is now going to be listened to in the context of the recent suicide of another Seattle musician, Kurt Cobain. Soundgarden's lyrics are equally obsessed with death and self-destruction. But Chris Cornell is trying to connect with his listeners in a way that Cobain may have considered uncool. At the same time, Soundgarden has tightened up its melodies and guitar riffs so they hit you like a fist. No loud rock music around right now has as much punch.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Soundgarden's new album, Super Unknown. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Greenlee, Sue Spolin, and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Our interns are Devin Reif, Ann Neville, and Philo Holland. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the songwriter of such soul classics as Do Right Woman, I'm Your Puppet, and Dark End of the Street. After writing hits for other singers, Dan Penn sings his own songs on his new album. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.